After writing letters complaining to the Bell Telephone Company about the color prejudice implied in only having black telephones, my uncle bought his telephone farm. It wasn't a farm in the beginning. It was more like a normal little house with a pond and quiet woods. Stocking the land with phones was his first problem. He'd meet phone linemen in the roadhouses that followed the telephone wires and offer them bribes for good breeding phones. In the beginning, he got fooled a lot because with phones like kittens, he couldn't tell male from female. But soon he became an adept, checking for strong circuits, good wiring, and firm plug-ins. My aunt made two huge compounds, one for each sex. The stud corral she papered with pages from Tropic of Cancer and reduced photographs of men's rooms walls. Next to that, she built the Philly station, plastered the sides with instructions on raising baby telephones. For a week, my uncle let the two pens sit side by side, each group listening to the other. The male phones roaring out raunchy bass dial tones, for the females dialed out four-letter area codes. When both groups were sufficiently frustrated, my uncle began his offspring program. He'd whisper night after night to the male phones about the beauties and vital charms of the numerous wild and domestic flowers about the farm. After a few weeks' exhortation, he let them all loose to fertilize the fauna. Unwarned, my aunt walked out that afternoon and fainted when she saw a particularly aggressive stud phone rape an unsuspecting tiger lily. Years later, she told me she still dreamed at night about the beetle-black form lurching across the grass, dripping oil from its base, and besmirching the lily with a tangle of cord and a stiff receiver. Uncle just tossed the female phones into the pond. He noticed the great number of turtles there as soon as he moved to the farm. Why not, he thought. Telephones and turtles look a lot alike. It didn't take him long to teach the female phones to say, "May I help you, please?" to a mock-up of a handsome young turtle. Then he threw them all into the pond and, as he said it, let nature take its course. He and my aunt walked around the pond one night soon after. Neither had seen any connections between turtles and phones. "I wonder if it's worth it, dear," he said. "It's hard being a dreamer." As she stroked his arm, he stopped walking and pointed out sharply to a log sitting in the middle of the pond. There in the moonlight sat a turtle and a buxom princess phone. The turtle had his flipper over the phone's dial, and in a soft voice he sang to her of spring water and soft mud. The next few weeks were busy with maternity preparation. My uncle would wait by the beach each day for a female phone to waddle out of the water and lay her eggs. When she'd finished and gone back to the pond, he'd dig out the eggs carefully and put them into an incubator. Within a couple of weeks, he had over 1,000 multicolored eggs ready to hatch. My aunt, meanwhile, was combing the woods for the spawn of the flower male phone mating. She found most of the babies around clumps of blushing flowers, looking like little toads and imitating bees or bird calls while they played. The male phones, for the most part, seemed to have deserted their families for the open road. The only stud she found was a pathetic phone that had fallen down a well. Unable to get out, he committed suicide by dialing 69 until his connection ran out. When my uncle asked her where she thought the bull phones were, she said she didn't know, but she assumed that wherever they were all busy. The baby phones grew by leaps and bounds on a daily feeding of live wires. When they grew up, he sold the whole rainbow lot to the phone company and retired to tend those that Bell wouldn't accept. The phones that flew and crowed in the morning, the ones with vines for cords and clumps of grapes for receivers, and the phones that lived in the trees, peeping like forest frogs, their dials luminous in the night shade. When love's body divines my hand, drawing this world as ours, the wings sewing our names with her shadow across the seasons, rain falling one to another, the river blooms, your hand is moved beneath the trees, roots seize the stream that cleaves you. These are the songs that turn in our eyes, birds moving in the sky's long throat, the voice of rivers riding the land to fall and reflow. We move within the memory of love, waking the fields we walked before meeting a deer's eyes that burst with the flame of our longing. Now we are like deer, arcing and falling. Like a deer's leaps, our hands are soothing the moon across the weave of night as we touch and burn our body. Tuba glue, please, said the kid, and slapped down two dimes. The storekeeper handed the kid his airplane embossed fix. Ravel, the glue that binds. Storekeeper doesn't ask. He knows. All the kids are building airplanes. Uh-huh. They all go out in the fields and build airplanes. In brown bags. They stumble around the streets building things in the bags. They're carrying flowers in the bags, carrying their Superman costumes, walking in bunches with the bags like masks on their faces, feeling strong. Then, as the herd of buffalo hit the barbed wire and thundered down on the little cluster of cowboys, I don't know what to say. The words you speak, the ways you move, make me think of someone I loved a long time ago. And I'll probably dream of you when I hold someone a year or so from now. One of the pauses I was telling you about. Suppose love is an old man in a 52 green Plymouth who has a grizzled face and a wrinkled beard and who nobody will put up for the night. So he sleeps in his car where cops won't bother him on a peaceful curb. And he pulls up slow to ask pedestrians for change for wine. And he asks young girls to go with him, but they all know him and won't go. 'Cause he rides the same routes and never leaves his one city. So that he always ends up with an old woman, and his or her 4 feet stick out the car back window at night. And they throw the wine bottles out the back window that's above their heads. And hopefully it's a street where nobody complains about their feet or the breaking bottles. And in the morning he gets up, and the sun's too bright, and their faces aren't young enough. So he lets her out and drives away, and he probably picks her up again that night. She'd drive her blue van into the huge parking lot around the shopping center, park amid the shoppers' cars, and shut the ignition off. She'd turn to the man beside her, smile, and together they'd walk into the back of the truck, draw the curtains on the back windows, and begin to make love on the couch she'd put there in the back. They had to visit different shopping centers each week because everybody got suspicious of the mysterious, moaning, rocking sky blue van. Besides, everybody noticed the way the black top puckered and rippled where they'd parked. But she always got what she'd been shopping for. This is just to warn you, Operator 772, against the day when I'll go mad with inevitable love for you. I'll go first to the bank and convert all my savings into fat rolls of dimes. And I'll go buy myself a welding torch,
find a phone booth, weld the door shut behind me, and start dialing home.
If I'm lucky, you'll answer in the first 100 tries.
Miss Collins, may I help you?
I'll breathe heavily for a while and stick my fingers up the silver coin return and wiggle them to see if you'll jump. Finally, with the delicacy of my insane love, I'll slowly unscrew the top of the phone receiver, take out the speaker, and stick my tongue on the two little circuits underneath and electrocute his boom.
Smoke will rise from your ear.
All your hair will straighten, and when they cart you away, your supervisor will turn to the ashen operators beside your chair and say,
"Now that was an obscene phone call."
At first, tourists saw the bodies appearing on the White House lawn, little brown corpses flickering like fireflies out of the air, until they materialized solidly on the grass like bizarre lawn castings. All the bodies were distinctly Vietnamese, or at least Oriental. Anybody who'd seen a UPI photograph or a newscast recognized the diminutive victims. But where were they coming from? Why were they appearing at our president's gate? Long after this disgusting matter reached the public eye, plainclothesmen with plastic bags tried to catch and cart away the relics. Then on national TV, while President Nixon talked over the nation's economic crisis, by some cosmic sleight of hand, the grinning head of an old woman appeared under Nixon's left elbow. Before the network cameras could work a quick fade out, a legless corpse hung like a pendant from the president's neck. In the papers the next day, there were confessions of horrified domestics who said that for weeks, bodies and even dismembered limbs had clogged the presidential corridors and the presidential bedchambers. Two masons confessed that they had built a huge oven to burn the yellow corpses, but there had been simply too many for service to handle. The White House issued a communique saying that a third party interested in undermining America's confidence in her leaders had perpetrated a malicious hoax. J. Edgar Hoover promised to run to earth the irreverent revolutionaries who try to besmirch our country with obscene displays. Later White House statements told of bodies appearing in similar fashion in Moscow, Hanoi, and Beijing. But these claims were unable to be substantiated. Shortly after this furor, the first corpses appeared on a national level. The incidents happened so quietly that it was weeks before the bodies were recognized as a national phenomenon. The first bodies didn't stink or decompose. That was to come later. They appeared in small towns and cities, occasionally floating solitary in a lake. Local authorities were baffled. Babies, children, old people. The corpses had no pattern, and at first the deaths seemed palatable, genteel. Many were unmarked, starvation probably. and more appeared, and each small town had its own victim. The manner of death became grislier. Napalmed women appeared on golf courses. Vietnamese girls hung by their entrails from street lamps. Not that they appeared all at once, or that there were many at one time. They just appeared at the most inappropriate places, at the most unmannerly times. One kept appearing in business elevators at lunchtime, its shattered skull, chin dripping blood, and the still damp mud on its legs. Others headless sat slumped in the seats of evening subways. Dead yellow-brown babies began appearing in laundry bags. More frightening were the limbs without bodies. Tongueless heads rolled slowly down movie theater aisles. Yellow fingers, knuckles, and toes turned up in TV dinners and bags of flour. At one prominent general's funeral, corpses erupted out of the open grave and forced the coffin out of the hole until the box was covered by the twisted dead. Airline pilots reported seeing bodies floating at all levels, drifting through the air like lost freight balloons. Motorists stopped for apparent hitchhikers that turned out to be bodies dead on their feet. Corpses appeared sitting in trees or staring blankly out of sewers or sat propped in corners and alleys. And finally, they began to rot. Some appeared half-rotting, the skull jutting from the sliding flush. Others rotted where people had left them for months out of fear. Moreover, the more recently arriving became grislier, the victims of torture, maiming, quadruple amputation in combat, eyes ruptured and dripping. Some even bled for days where they lay, gallons beyond what they had held in life. With the active assault to the senses, authorities took to trying to collect the corpses and bury them or burn them in heaps outside of town. But the corpses reappeared from where they had been removed. Anti-Vietnamese mobs sprang up around the country, denouncing Vietnam for the cruel atrocities she was practicing on the United States. News commentators and national leaders began to ask by what right had the privacy of the United States been violated, especially by a country for whom we had done so much. But gradually we began to ignore the bodies, to run them over in the streets, to kick them off the sidewalks, not to see them though their dead faces leered at us as we pursued our daily lives. And so in the face of their threatening silence, we returned to the peace and sanity we had before they appeared.
I'd like to thank Peter Dickinson on piano and organ, Al Brown on trumpet and recorder, Art Soldier for doing most of the arranging and the organizing for this, as well as the guitar work and the piano work, Steve Somber on violin, and Don Person, who organized all the electrical zoo that we have here. Thank you. Thank you.